Versatile Times. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The Spanish region of Catalonia is reportedly preparing to declare independence, perhaps Monday, following last Sunday's referendum deemed illegal by the central government. Catalan President Carles Puigdemont, in a televised address, said he preferred mediation with Madrid. Spain's Deputy Prime Minister, Soraya Sáenz de Santamaría, said the Catalan message is one of uneasiness and a journey to nowhere. She said Puigdemont is living outside the law. The European Union Wednesday appealed for dialogue. Frans Timmermans is the EU Commission first vice president.
The power of dialogue, of sitting down and talking to each other, even if and especially when we passionately disagree, is what our union is built on.
He said it's time to work within the constitutional order of Spain to find a way out of the impasse. European analyst Bruce Wilson of Australia's RMIT University said dialogue appears the only way out.
This, of course, goes back for the best part of a decade that the Catalans have been seeking to renegotiate the terms of their relationship with the Spanish national constitution, and I think the time for dialogue is very much at the forefront of people's minds.
While most Catalans who cast ballots voted for independence on Sunday, only about 40% took part in the referendum. Health officials in Madagascar are trying to contain an outbreak of the plague in the Indian Ocean country that has killed as many as 30 over the past 2 months. They've recorded nearly 200 suspected cases. The World Health Organization said the outbreak is being found in urban areas, raising the risk of wider transmission. The government has banned large public gatherings to curb the spread of the disease. The bacteria is usually found in rats and spread by infected fleas. This is VOA News. President Donald Trump visited Las Vegas, Nevada, Wednesday's scene of modern America's worst mass shooting in which nearly 60, including the lone gunman, were killed. Nearly 500 others were wounded. Mr. Trump said America is a nation in mourning.
Many families tonight will go to bed in a world that is suddenly empty. The people they so dearly love were torn away from them forever.
Mr. Trump visited the hospital bedsides of many of the wounded and addressed the nation from a local police station where he spoke of the grief shared nationally for those who lost loved ones.
We struggle for the words to explain to our children how such evil can exist, how there can be such cruelty and such suffering. But we cannot be defined by the evil that threatens us or the violence that incites such terror.
Mr. Trump said in times like these, Americans come together.
In the months ahead, we will all have to wrestle with the horror of what has unfolded this week, but we will struggle through it together. We will endure the pain together, and we will overcome together as Americans.
Law enforcement officials said the lone gunman, Stephen Paddock, likely acted by himself and was not part of an international terror group. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson Wednesday denied reports he's considering resigning.
My commitment to the success of our president and our country is as strong as it was the day I accepted his offer to serve as Secretary of State.
NBC News has reported Tillerson has been openly critical of Mr. Trump, and Vice President Mike Pence and other officials have had to intervene to persuade him to stay on. Tillerson said he's never had to be persuaded to stay because he never considered leaving. Russian warplanes are suspected of carrying out a strike that killed dozens of civilians trying to flee fighting in Syria's Deir ez-Zor province as they attempted to cross the Euphrates River by boat. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said children were among those killed. In Libya, at least 4 people were killed and dozens wounded Wednesday in a suicide attack on a court complex in the city of Misrata. Islamic State claimed responsibility, saying it was targeting what it called a prominent stronghold of the UN-backed Government of National Accord. Turkey and Iran Wednesday presented a united front in their opposition to the independence aspirations of Kurds in northern Iraq. Speaking in Tehran, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said our determination is clear. We deal with the central government in Baghdad and the referendum is illegitimate, a reference to the September 25 vote in Iraqi Kurdistan. A Turkish court Wednesday found more than 40 former soldiers guilty of trying to kill President Erdogan during last year's failed coup, handing each a life sentence. Aggravated life is the harshest sentence under Turkish law. No verdict was reached in the case of U.S.-based exiled cleric Fethullah Gulen, whom Ankara blames for orchestrating the coup. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Togo's opposition coalition calls for more protests today to force the resignation of President Faure Gnassingbé.
We want to return to the constitution of 1992, and we want the head of state to resign. That's all we want.
Jean-Pierre Fabre is the leader of Togo's main opposition National Alliance for Change Party. Fuel shortages in South Sudan's capital continue to affect commuters and businesses alike. Guinea-Bissau's economy is projected to grow to 5.5% this year. And a Ugandan opposition member of parliament calls for the resignation of the speaker.
When you suspend members, you're supposed to follow a certain procedure. You ask the sergeant at arms to remove members. Peacefully, the sergeant at arms was nowhere to be seen. The speaker did not follow any of those procedures.
Norbert Mao is the leader of the opposition Democratic Party of Uganda. A spokesman says President Ernest Bai Koroma is not trying to handpick his successor, and the campaign is underway to tackle baby killings in Nigeria's capital. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Togo, a 14-party opposition coalition has called for more protests today, Thursday, to force the resignation of President Faure Gnassingbé. Jean-Pierre Fabre, leader of Togo's main opposition National Alliance for Change Party, says the aim of the protest is to demand a return to the country's 1992 constitution, which established a two-term limit for the presidency. But in 2002, the legislature amended the constitution to allow Faure Gnassingbé's father, Iyadema, to run for a third term. President Faure Gnassingbé, in power since 2005, is proposing a referendum to change the constitution to a 2 5-year term of office. The African Union and the Economic Community of West African States have urged the opposition to support the process. But Jean-Pierre Fabre says the Togolese people have had enough of the more than 50-year rule of President Gnassingbé and his late father.
We want to return to the constitution of 1992, and we want the head of state to resign. That's all we want. And this business of referendum, we don't understand it. Mr. Faure Gnassingbé refuses 10 years ago to execute the Accord Politique Global. And now we are talking about referendum with the bad conditions of election in Togo. We in Togo, we refuse this kind of referendum. I tell you, we will not accept.
Why does the opposition not want to go to referendum?
Because the purpose of the referendum is a bad purpose, and the condition of elections in Togo are always bad. That's why we are asking about the return to the constitution of 1992.
Are you willing to dialogue with the government?
Yes, we know we must dialogue, but only to talk about the conditions of the resign of Mr. Faure Gnassingbé. His father and him have done more than 50 years in power. It is not acceptable.
But President Faure Gnassingbé was elected. Can the opposition wait until he has served his term?
He has never been elected. Never. Fraudulent election all the time. In 2005, 2010, and 2016, always fraudulent election. And next international community knows that deeply. And they always are talking about stability. And so they closed eyes on those things. And now we say in Togo, enough is enough.
We understand there have been some violence. Who is responsible for violence?
We are not violent, and everybody knows that we are not violent. But the government is very violent. Last week, I was in the north of the country, and many people crossed the border in the north to go to Ghana because of the violence of the military. I have seen what they have done there in the north. All those times, the international community close the eyes on what is done in Togo. And now we say enough is enough.
So what do you say to ECOWAS that is calling for the referendum to take place?
We say ECOWAS, as usual, is doing bad things. If ECOWAS wants to be involved in the Togolese crisis, to oblige us to go to referendum without the execution of Accord Politique Global. We in Togo, we refuse this kind of referendum. And this referendum they are talking about will not take place in Togo.
Jean-Pierre Fabre is the leader of Togo's main opposition National Alliance for Change party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lome. The leader of the Democratic Party of Uganda says Speaker of Parliament Rebecca Kadaga should resign for what he calls a breach of procedures resulting to chaos in Parliament. Norbert Mao accuses the Speaker of being partial and failing to control the House. But Uganda's Prime Minister Ruhakanda Rugunda has praised the Speaker, saying she was pushed into suspending some members of Parliament. Mugumi Davis Rakarinch reports from Kampala.
While addressing journalists this Tuesday, Mao said Speaker Kadaga planned on humiliating those opposed to lifting of age limit from the Ugandan constitution.
When you suspend members, you are supposed to follow a certain procedure. You ask the sergeant at arms to remove members peacefully. The sergeant at arms was nowhere to be seen. If the members don't move peacefully, the sergeant at arms is supposed to report to the speaker that the members have refused to vacate the chamber. Thereafter, the speaker is supposed to announce to the entire parliament that the use of force is now necessary to remove the members. The speaker did not follow any of those procedures.
The sergeant at arms is an official working in the parliament, usually a police officer, mandated to maintain order and security. There was chaos in the parliament last week when security personnel, believed to be those attached to the protection of the president, stormed the parliament, exchanged blows with parliamentarians before forcefully evicting them. While addressing journalists yesterday, Prime Minister Rugunda acknowledged other members of security organs besides the police participated in the eviction of legislators, but says the speaker acted lawfully.
We also salute the Right Honourable Speaker of Parliament and Deputy Speaker of Parliament, one, for being absolutely tolerant. They were extremely tolerant because their orders, their authority was defied, disrespected, but they kept their calm. But eventually, after being overstretched, they took the necessary decisions to restore order in the House.
Last week, Speaker Kadaga suspended 24 opposition MPs and Water Minister Ronald Kibule, who smuggled a gun into the parliament, and ordered them to leave the house immediately. Opposition leader Mao, who also formerly served as a parliamentarian, says he too would have disregarded Kadaga's orders to leave the parliament.
The opposition MPs who were openly opposed to the lifting of the age limit are probably only about 50 plus some NRM members and independent MPs. But the knowledge that we are solidly behind them gave them the guts to confront 200 armed Special Force Command members. I don't like violence in Parliament, but I'm not going to stand here and say I don't understand why they fought.
The Parliament is expected to resume today, where the bill aimed at removing the age cap for one standing for the presidency will be debated.
Our aim should be to see that this diversity of views, instead of being looked at negatively, is looked at positively, because it is the richness of those views, interaction of view, those views, panel beating of those views, that at the end of the day will bring what the people of Uganda actually want.
Prime Minister Rugunda says, consequently, MPs will be dispatched to their respective constituents to make sure they consult with the population. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 5th. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Fuel shortages in South Sudan's capital, Juba, continue to affect commuters and businesses alike. President Salva Kiir formed a committee back in August this year to end the sale of fuel on the black market. He also promised to ensure a steady supply of fuel to stations across the country. Analysts say the government's failure to crack down on the illegal sale of fuel has further aggravated the problem. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Fuel is back on the black market here, despite President Kiir's orders to crack down its illegal sale. Petrol stations in Juba are not allowed to sell fuel in plastic containers or drums to prevent fuel getting into the hands of black market vendors. Ross Joan sells petrol in small bottles under an umbrella along a street in Juba's Nyakron area. Speaking in Arabic, she says she gets her fuel supply from motorists.
We are getting this from the car drivers because it's prohibited for us to buy fuel from the filling stations in jerrycans.
Joan says motorists buy 20 liters of petrol from the stations at 440 South Sudanese pounds and turn around and sell it for 5,000 South Sudanese pounds. She says she makes 6,000 South Sudanese pounds from selling 20 liters of fuel on the black market. She says her business is quite profitable. Sanjok Angelo, who also sells fuel, says in Arabic that many residents in Juba are able to provide for their families by trading on the black market.
There are some people like these women. They are suffering and others have no husbands. But through selling the fuel in the black market, they can send their children to school or even provide food.
Angelo says the business can be lucrative but risky due to frequent police crackdowns on vendors. Jamal Hassan is the manager of the Dire petrol station located at Juba's customs market. Hassan says he gets his fuel supply from Nile Petroleum, a government-owned company that manages the nation's oil supply, exploration and marketing of oil.
People they are taking from the station in the vehicle, they are taking the government vehicles.
James Alech Garang, an economist with the Ebony Center for Strategic Studies, says as long as government officials are indirectly involved in the fuel business and the commodity is scarce, it will be difficult to stop the sale of fuel on the black market. Garang says the government must enact tougher laws to punish individuals who sell fuel on the black market.
If the government officials also involved in black marketing, why they are the ones saying fuel should not be taken to the black market, then it is already spoiled.
Garang says the government should contract an independent group to store and manage the fuel supply and distribution in the country. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
There's been good news lately for Guinea-Bissau's economy. The International Monetary Fund this week wrapped up a visit to the country and projected economic growth for 2017 at 5.5%. The African Development Bank also granted the government a loan to boost its electricity production. Despite this, the political situation remains at an impasse. A spokesman for the Movement of Conscious and Nonconformist Citizens, Carlos De Silva, tells Reiki Shryak regular citizens are not feeling the benefits of the good economic news.
Talking about the economy and the life of Guinea-Bissau people is very sorrowful to say because people are suffering. The basic things, the prices going up, you know, every single day. You see the rice that is the basic food for our population is going up to the 20,000, which is not normal. You see some people are receiving more or less, the minimum salary is 29,000. And if someone is buying a rice by 20,000, they will just remain with 9,000. That's quite impossible, you see. And you see all other basic things that people need is very expensive because the government is increasing the taxes every day.
What did they increase taxes on?
For example, this basic need product like rice, oil, every basic things they are increasing the taxes, you see. The taxes go on. Even 3 months or 4 months ago, they tried to increase also, for example, the taxes of lights and electricity.
Speaking of electricity, they've also just this week, it looks like the West African Development Bank has given Bissau a 25 billion CFA loan to boost the power production. Would this help regular Bissau Guineans access electricity, where the electrification rate of the country is about 22%?
You see, these last days, we have been a lot of power cut. Before 2-3 months, 4 months ago, we had regularly the electricity, but this 1 month ago, by now, we have been a lot of power cut and water. You know, this is very complicated. Even, for example, in my neighborhood, last week, we stayed three days without having light. You know, this is not normal. It's not fair.
Is there concern that these international institutions, the IMF, the West African Development Bank, are working with the government of Guinea-Bissau, but as your group says, that government is not working with the people?
You know, there's something that happened internationally that people do not understand. You have an illegal government on place. The parliament has not convened for almost three years, and the crisis is going on all around, and the institutional are not working together, and the politicians are divided, and the country is in the chaos. How can you back up such government? So mean that if you put this money, it's just in vain, because the population cannot see this money. It's not benefiting the population.
Carlos De Silva is spokesperson for the Movement of Conscious and Nonconformist Citizens. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Guinea-Bissau's capital, Bissau. A 709.4-carat diamond discovered earlier this year by a pastor is in Belgium for auction and sale, according to the Sierra Leone government. Abdoulaye Birete, spokesperson for President Ernest Bai Koroma, says officials will meet with potential buyers to discuss the best price for the diamond. The diamond, one of the 20 biggest in the world, is valued at over $50 million by diamond experts. A $7.7 million bid for the gem failed to materialize last July in Freetown. Birete denies the diamond is overpriced.
As I'm speaking to you now, officials from the National Minerals Agency, led by the Director General, were in Antwerp, Belgium, where the diamond was safely handed over to the Rapoport Group, which is a fiduciary agent with an expertise in the auctioning of such diamonds. And we did this with the full involvement of the pastor, Momo himself, as well as the chief in whose chiefdom the diamond was found dead. That was Chief Sakui and Pastor Emmanuel Momo, as I'm speaking to you now, secured a Schengen visa through the support of the government, and they are in Belgium to make sure that they are involved in the entire process as instructed by His Excellency the President.
Why has it taken this long to get this diamond sold? Is it because maybe the government overpriced the diamond?
Well, no. The diamond was never overpriced. In fact, prior to the fourth bidding we held in May this year in Freetown, we involved the Kimberley experts and also the Belgian Diamond Council. They supported the government in reaching at a reserve price. But unfortunately, the reserve price wasn't met. And that was when the government and the pastor held consultation and the president gave the green light for the diamond to be taken out of the country, against the insistence of the president initially that a diamond must be sold in Sierra Leone. And this is where we had to go into a legal agreement with the Rapoport Group as well. And fortunately for us, the Rapoport said they are not going to charge the government anything. They wanted to support the diamond because it is going to transform the image of the country in terms of the transparency with which we have put it on sale.
Abdoulaye Birete, spokesman for Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma. You are speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. a 20-year grassroots campaign to end the cultural practice of ritual infanticide among indigenous communities around the Nigerian capital of Abuja is yielding success. The Bassa Komo people have a historic practice of killing babies that are perceived to be evil, including twins and albinos. But efforts by a local missionary and the government have helped to reduce the number of killings. Chika Odua reports from the Nigerian Capital Territory.
These babies were almost killed. They were all branded as evil by their communities. Twins, like Henrik and Henrika, are believed to be bad spirits.
Multiple births are not acceptable to them. And when they deliver such children, they are poisoned with their local herbs. The child is abandoned in a room, not to be touched by anybody. Is already tagged an evil child. Nobody wants to nurse that baby, no food, no water. And they believe that leaving a child who lost his mother, that is going to spread the evil that they are used to kill the mother among the villagers, so they don't want them to leave.
Stephen Ajayi runs this rescue center in the outskirts of Abuja. It's part of his work as a Christian missionary. This place has become a shelter for so-called evil children. Albinos, twins, triplets, and even babies whose upper teeth appeared before the lower set of teeth are all at risk. Ajayi opened the Vine Heritage Home in 2004 and has been taking care of the children, all 119 of them. He makes sure the older ones get to school every morning. For generations, ethnic communities indigenous to the Nigerian Capital Territory have practiced ritual infanticide.
Twins were born in this compound many years ago. The twin babies were killed, and afterwards, the family set up this altar. The family believes that the spirits of the twin babies live here. Twice a year, the family offers sacrifices of chickens and goats to the spirits. They believe that this will prevent the spirits of the twin babies from coming back to haunt the community.
Alkali Magaji is the spiritual leader of this village called Kaida.
Our children believe that these children come from the evil one and no one wants it. We have a god we call Otachi, and we offer the children to that god. We suspect those children to be witches or wizards. That's why we eliminate them.
The government began investigating infanticide in 2013 and kicked off a campaign to eradicate the practice. Dr. Matthew Ashikeni said the investigation revealed that babies born with abnormalities were also at risk.
If a kid is born with a cleft lip or cleft palate, which are defects in the the lips, all right, or the palate, all right, or those kids that come with the malformation that will lead to the head being so big, all right, we call it hydrocephalus medically.
But he says the campaign is having an effect. Infanticide is on the decline. Aisha Ayuba gave birth to twins this year. She decided to give them away to the rescue center where they could have a chance at life. Ajayi works with local chiefs to enlighten communities. This chief says they are working towards doing away with the harmful traditions of their forefathers.
We are happy seeing twins here alive, and there is no trouble.
Kutara Village is one of the first communities that agreed to stop practicing infanticide. But in other communities, the practice has gone further underground. Twin babies born in this village just a few months ago have disappeared, according to local residents.
If they are not here, I don't think any of them will be alive.
These children don't know if they will ever see their parents again, or even visit their native communities, but they do know that they are alive. Chika Odua for VOA News in the Nigerian Capital Territory.
And that is it for this Thursday, October 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali,
host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a look at the Grace Hopper celebration. The conference is the world's largest gathering of women in technology. We'll recap the events in Orlando, Florida, and speak with African women working in the industry in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere for their perspective on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.